Mark chapter 5, verse 21. And when Jesus had crossed again in the boat to the other side, a great crowd gathered about him, and he was beside the sea. Then came one of the rulers of the synagogue, Jairus, by name, and seeing him, he fell at his feet and implored him earnestly, saying, "My little daughter is at the point of death. Come and lay your hands on her so that she may be made well and live." And he went with him. And a great crowd followed him and thronged about him. And there was a woman who had a discharge of blood for 12 years and who had suffered much under many physicians and had spent all that she had and was no better, but rather grew worse. She had heard the reports about Jesus and came up behind him in the crowd and touched his garment. For she said, if I touch even his garments, I will be made well. And immediately the flow of blood dried up, and she felt in her body that she was healed of her disease. And Jesus, perceiving in himself that power had gone out from him, immediately turned about in the crowd and said, "Who touched my garments?" And his disciples said to him, "You see the crowd pressing around you, and yet you say, 'Who touched me?'" And he looked around to see who had done it. But the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came in fear and trembling and fell down before him and told him the whole truth. And he said to her, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your disease." While he was still speaking, there came from the ruler's house some who said, "Your daughter is dead. Why trouble the teacher any further?" But overhearing what they said, Jesus said to the ruler of the synagogue, "Do not fear, only believe." And he allowed no one to follow him except Peter and James and John, the brother of James. They came to the house of the ruler of the synagogue, and Jesus saw a commotion, people weeping and wailing loudly. And when he entered, he said to them, "Why are you making a commotion and weeping? The child is not dead, but sleeping." And they laughed at him. But he put them all outside and took the child's father and mother and those who were with him and went in where the child was. Taking her by the hand, he said to her, "Talitha kumi," which means, "Little girl, I say to you, arise." And immediately the girl got up and began walking, for she was 12 years of age, and they were immediately overcome with amazement. And he strictly charged them that no one should know this and told them to give her something to eat. The grass withers and the flower fades, but the word of our Lord stands forever. This morning I want to explore with you, discuss with you, the beauties of a relationship with Jesus Christ, two in particular. And I think that this is a topic we ought to be interested in, because I think that it, no matter what circumstance we're in, no matter what phase of life we're in, is pertinent to us as human beings and as Christians. Many of us, we're of different ages, we're of different socioeconomic brackets, we're of different experiences, different skin colors, we are different people. Some of us feel like life is going okay right now, and some of us are quietly hurting even as we sit in this pew. And the question is, why ought you, where you are in your life, want Christianity to be true? Why would you want a relationship with Jesus Christ? Some of you may be this morning investigating the truth claims of Christianity. You may be skeptical about them. You may have grown up in the church and still be skeptical about them. Or maybe you're just jaded. Maybe you've been deeply wounded in this church, and you're just not sure about Jesus or his church. Why ought you want Christianity to be true? What's good about it? Or maybe some of us are sort of, we come each Sunday morning and we enjoy the worship service and we like to hear the hymns and the sermon. But as far as the week, it doesn't translate so much into our life what we hear here. And we certainly don't join in to the fellowship because, again, church can be scary. So you're kind of on the margins. Why don't you want to be drawn in? To become committed. And for you here who have been Christians for years and wholeheartedly with your mind believe what the Bible says about Jesus Christ and what he brings, nonetheless, Christianity may have grown stale in your mouth. It may have grown dry in your heart. And what is it about a relationship with Jesus Christ that is so good that it can bring life back to your faith? There's a lot of things to say that we could say to those questions. And we're only going to say two. And in fact, there's more in this passage. I had to cut so much stuff. I just had too much. There's so many things to say, even from this very rich passage. But I want to point our attention to two things. That two things that are beautiful about a relationship with Jesus Christ when you make contact with him by faith is that he transforms your identity and he gives you a hope and a meaning in life that suffering and even death can't take away. Those are two things. He transforms our identities and he gives us a hope and a meaning in life that suffering and even death cannot take away. So first, he transforms our identities. I want you to look at the experience of this woman in particular, but we have to set the scene. We're immediately confronted with Jairus, who is a synagogue ruler, who comes to Jesus and he's in desperation. And the reason that he's in desperation is because his daughter is dying. And if you look in the passage in verse 23, it says, Jairus came to Jesus and he fell at his feet and implored him earnestly, saying, "My little daughter is at the point of death. Come and lay your hands on her." Now, I'm saying it really too calmly. He's desperate and he is imploring Jesus, "My daughter is about to die. Please come." The word here is really more saying she's at death's door. Or to say it a different way, she's dying in the moment. As they have this conversation, she is about to die. Jairus is in a rush. He's in a mental sprint to get home. And so Jesus agrees. And you can imagine the joy and hope that fills this man's heart. And at the same time, the fear that they're going to be too late. And so they go. And a crowd forms around them, it says. And in verse 24, it says, "And a great crowd followed him and thronged about him." And that word is that the crowd is getting very, very thick. It's actually the same word that you would use of an army that is besieging a city. Jesus is surrounded by people who have come to see him heal this little girl. It's a prominent member of their society, a synagogue ruler, and his little daughter is on the verge of death. They want to see the healing. And Jesus is trapped in this crowd. And then a woman comes up to him, an unnamed woman who has a chronic disease for 12 years, who's had it for 12 years. And she touches the Jesus' cloak, his garments, and she is immediately healed. And then something startling takes place. Jesus stops. He stops the procession of people. This is a moment. This is an emergency situation. It's a moment that in our world would require an ambulance. It's an ambulance situation in a world where people are reserved or restricted most of the time to walking. And Jesus has the audacity to stop and to have a conversation with a woman about her faith. What is going on? Why the delay? And the answer is that in this conversation, compressed for sure in our account, but we have the outlines of it, Jesus is about to transform this woman's identity, privately and publicly. If you look at this woman in her description, verse 25, she was a woman who had a discharge of blood for 12 years and who had suffered much under many physicians and had spent all that she had, and she was no better, but rather had grew worse. And she had heard reports, she comes, touches his garments, and then she tries to leave and get out of there. But Jesus asks, "Who touched me?" and makes her come forward. So this is the one we're presented. And it may not be totally obvious on the face when you read this passage, but actually every level of this woman's identity is broken. Every aspect of what makes us up as people and the way we understand ourselves and experience life in the world and with other people is damaged for her. Physically, she's suffering. for 12 years. She's had some sort of problem with her reproductive system. We're not sure what it is, but she has a bleeding that won't go away, that is constant and perpetual. And not only is she suffering physically, but she's suffered at the hands of her doctors. Mark goes out of his way to tell us that she's not only suffering from the disease, but from the cures that are being put forward as to help her disease. And so for 12 long years, she's suffered physically. And then Mark also tells us that economically, she's resourceless. She has no money. She spent it all on doctors, all on these cures in vain. She's at the bottom of the social ladder. But there's more than that. Unclean. The bleeding would have made her unclean. And so religiously, she can't go to the temple. She can't worship. She can't join into the central activity of the life of her society, which also socially makes her an outcast. It is very likely that this woman has no friends. And this is astounding to me. And it is also very likely that she has not been touched in any way, not even a hug, for 12 years. She has had no human connection. And so psychologically, we can see this in her hiding, in her running away, in her not wanting to be noticed by the crowd. She has a sense of failure and shame, and she is full of fear. And Jesus pauses and asks, "Who touched me?" And she comes forward, and Jesus in this moment changes her life. He restores her on every level. Physically, she's healed, which means economically, she's freed from the doctor bills, and she can begin to recover. The healing makes her clean. Ceremonially, she now can revisit, after such a long period, worship with her people and her God at the temple, at the synagogue. And Jesus, it's fascinating that he makes her come. It seems almost cruel at first, until you realize that he is healing her in front of the people who would have known to avoid her, and in front of a synagogue ruler, Jairus. He is not only privately but publicly restoring this woman to life. He is giving her her life back. And on an internal level, he says to her, verse 34, after she makes her confession to him that it was her, and she's full of fear, he says, "Daughter, daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace." The storm that is raging inside of you can be calm. Because you abandon your fears for a moment and you came to me in faith, weak though it was, you may have peace. And he calls this unnamed woman daughter, a term of intimacy and belonging. He restores her. He transforms her identity on every level. Three weeks ago, we went to Colorado, RYM Colorado, with the youth. RYM is a youth retreat, if you know what that is. And a guy named Brian Sorgenfrey just did some amazing preaching. And one of the things that he said about himself, but more broadly about the topic of identity, is that when we understand the way we think about ourselves, we have an inner tension, an inner sense of failure. And the way that he explained it was, he started talking about the fact that he himself, but everybody else that he's met also, has an ideal self and a real self. And he starts to explain this, and it was almost laughable, because I was thinking, I think exactly this way. And so I'm just going to speak for me. Here is the way that every day I imagine the next day, my ideal self. I imagine that I'm going to get up early at 5:30 or 6 in the morning, and I'm going to go work out. and I'm going to feel myself getting stronger and faster and more fit. And I'm going to be able to look at myself in the mirror and like wink, you know. And then, you know, I'll clean up. Sarah and Evelyn Claire will wake up. Sarah's my wife. Evelyn Claire's my daughter. And they'll wake up and they'll be happy to see me, and I'll be happy to see them, and we'll have breakfast and maybe like a devotional time, and then patiently and calmly we'll walk out the door, and I'll go to RTS to do some counseling, and I'll say something that kind of, you know, helps change someone's life, and then I'll prepare a lesson for the youth and come deliver that and help change another person's life, and then I'll go home very content, and we'll have a nice evening, a dinner, and we'll go to bed. The problem is, so that's my ideal self. Like, that's who I imagine myself to be. That's who I want to be. The problem is, that's never once happened. Not once. So I have this problem, right? That I have a real self. And my real Monday mornings look like this. This is what tomorrow will look like. I have to be at RTS at 7 a.m. And I'm going to get up late at 6 to 6:15 because I'm tired from Sunday. And then I won't eat breakfast, I won't work out, and I won't have a devotional time, and I'll rush out the door as Sarah and Evelyn Claire get up, and I'll feel this vague tension and frustration and anger that I'm having to rush so hard. And then I'll go to the clinic, I'll see my clients, I'll be confused by what they're saying, not know how to help them. I won't make the youth lesson because I'll have to eat lunch in the afternoon and I'm so hungry. And then I'll come home after not making the, no. And then I'll have clients in the evening who will confuse me further, get home at 9 p.m. And Sarah and I will listen to Evelyn Claire cry because she's tired and hungry. And we'll talk for 45 minutes about what TV show we want to watch, but actually not choose one and then go to bed. Right? That's the real me. That's the real me. And I'm wondering if you have a similar dialogue in your head, where you have a standard, a person that you imagine, a person you long and want to be, comical though I made it. And when you look at who you really are, you fall short. And so you have an inner sense of failure. And there's another aspect of this. Not only do we have an ideal self and this real self, we also have a public self. And the public self is the many sets of personas that we take on with people. I'm this way at church, I'm this way at work, I'm this way with my kids, I'm this way with my wife. And the public self is all about controlling other people's perceptions, or at least attempting to. And we put on a mask and we say, you can see this much and you may not see anything else. Because we're afraid. We're afraid of people's looks. We're afraid of their inner judgments to us, toward us. We're afraid of annoying them and being a burden to them, and them thinking about us that way. We're afraid of the gossip. In this conversation that Jesus is having with this woman presents to us a question. And the question that it's presenting to us is, what if Jesus wants to know all of who you are? The ideal self that you feel you fail, the public self that you only show so much because of your fears, and the vulnerable, hurt, ashamed, guilty, broken self that says, I will never let this part of myself be seen. I'm too ashamed. I'm too guilty. I'm too ugly. I'm too dumb. I'm too overweight. I'm too abused. I'm too addicted. You know, I look at those things on the computer. I take another drink. I yelled at my children. I screamed at them. I hurt them. I yelled at my wife. I gossiped about my husband. I ran him down to all of my friends. I said things to my parents that I can't say in public because I can barely say it to myself because it makes me shiver. to think how ungrateful those words were. Whatever it is, what if Jesus wants to see you? What if he's inviting you to come to him, to lay it all before him, every bit of it, the ideal self, the public self, and the vulnerable, hurt, broken, ashamed self? And what if he would look at you and say, child, your faith has made you well. Go in peace. Jesus transforms our identities when we meet him and make contact with him in faith. He changes our lives from the inside out. He gives us this invaluable gift of being seen and heard and simultaneously loved and cherished. That you can be completely known all the way down to every embarrassing detail and utterly loved and accepted by him forever. And you know what? You know why that changes your identity? Because this unique combination of characteristics starts to emerge in you. Humility and confidence at the same time. Though they may seem opposed, because humility, you know your flaws, you know your sin and your guilt, you know your failures, because you no longer have to avoid them. You can be honest about them. You can come to Jesus with them in hand. And so you're humble. And at the same time, you're confident because you know you're loved to the skies. You know that you're his child, that you have a place of belonging, and you're in his family. It's this remarkable thing. So first point, Jesus changes our identity. Secondly, and this point is a little bit hard-hitting, we have a hope and a meaning that can't be taken away, even in suffering and even in death. A hope and a meaning that can't be taken away in suffering and even in death. I want you to think back to Jairus at this moment. This woman's greatest moment is Jairus' worst moment. Verse 35 is excruciating. Look at verse 35. While he was still speaking, there came from the ruler's house someone who said, your daughter is dead. There's nothing in Jairus' life that would have prepared him for this moment. Contrast Jairus and this woman. He is a man, and she is a woman, which would have mattered a lot in that society. And then, not only is he a man, being told by Jesus, in effect, hold on, wait a minute, for me to talk to this lady. But he's also a synagogue ruler who has committed his life to God, who has given devotion to God. And Jesus spends time in the moment of his greatest need with this unclean woman. And so while Jesus is still speaking, he gets a report that his worst nightmare has come true and that his daughter has died. And we don't have time to go into this, but it is an affront to his whole purpose in life, what's going on in this moment. And one of the reasons why it is so palpably strong is because because death has come to his door, has come near him. Death for us, the death, our own death, our own mortality, not something that we like to think about. Not a comfortable topic. Our own mortality and our own death and the death of our loved ones is the great destroyer of our hope and meaning in life. It's interesting to me that whenever I read biblical stories, who is named and who isn't. Jairus is named, but the women in the passage are not. And you may say, that's how things happened back then. Men were paid attention to. It's probably not that. It's probably that Jairus was still alive and that he was an since he was an eyewitness to this and you wanted to go corroborate this story, you could go talk to him. But nonetheless, we don't even know this woman's name. All we know about Jairus is his title and his name. And we don't even know this little girl's name. In other words, we get a little slice of these people's lives, and largely, they're forgotten. And the reason is because death and time erases us and our memory. Unless you do something absolutely extraordinary, your best hope is that you will be remembered, hopefully fondly, but that's not even always the case, by your children and your grandchildren. Leo Tolstoy was a Russian writer, and this fact about death brought him to a crisis in his life when he was about 50 years old. And it actually was the turning point for him to come to faith. And he writes about it in a writing called My Confession. And I want to read you a passage from this where Tolstoy says this better than I can. He says this: "Something strange began to happen to me at age 50. I had a wife who loved me and whom I loved. I had a large estate, which without much effort on my part increased. My name was respected. I enjoyed physical strength, and yet I could not live because of death. The question which brought me to the verge of suicide was, is there any meaning in life that my inevitable death does not destroy? Today or tomorrow, death will come to those I love and then to me. Soon, not only will I not exist, but eventually no one will exist who will remember anything I have written or done. Why then go on with the effort? What is it all for? What does it all lead to? What difference does it make whether or not I do this thing or that thing or nothing at all? So I could give no rational meaning to any single action or even to my whole life. But what is so surprising is how we can fail to see this. For a time it is possible to live intoxicated with life. But as soon as one is sober, it is impossible not to see that life in the face of death is a fraud, and a stupid fraud. How often have I been told, oh, you cannot understand the meaning of life, so don't think about it, just live. But I can no longer do that." See, what Tolstoy is putting on the table before us, and what this passage is putting on the table before us, is it's getting us to reckon with the seeming purposelessness and hopelessness that our own death and the death of our loved ones brings to our life. And so what are we going to do about this? What's the answer? And the answer is Jesus Christ's interaction with this little girl. Go to verse 40. "And they laughed at him because he said that she's not dead but sleeping." Even though, don't let that confuse you, she is dead. "But he put them all outside and took the child's father and mother and those who were with him and went in where the child was, taking her by the hand. He said to her, 'Talitha kumi,' which means, 'Little girl, I say to you, arise.' And immediately the girl got up and began walking." Jesus' interaction with this girl is notable because of what he says to her. He says this phrase, "Talitha kumi." And then the translation that's given, it's a good translation. It says, "Little girl, I say to you, arise." But nonetheless, though it's an accurate translation, it does not communicate what's actually being said here. Because little girl in English is something that you would say to like a little girl that you see in a grocery store who is lost. And you would address her, because she's a stranger, "Little girl, is your mom around?" It's something that you address to someone you don't know. But Talitha wasn't like that. It was an intimate name. It was a pet name. It was like sweetie, like sweetheart, honey. That's what Jesus is saying to her. And when it says, "Little girl, arise," that sounds very regal, like a king rising from his throne. But that's not it either. It just means time to get up. And so literally what he's saying is what this little girl would have heard from her mother every day of her life. "Little girl," or "sweetheart, it's time to get up." And she gets up. Jesus, turns death into a good night's sleep. With effortless power, he reaches in and brings life out of death. And what that means for us is not only that Jesus is powerful, but that he's also trustworthy. That he's not going to use this power against us, that he actually wants to use it for the greatest well-being that we can imagine. If you are fortunate in life and you live the longest out of your family and friends, what that means is that you will bury them. You will see their caskets go into the ground. And that's if you're the fortunate one. And what Jesus is saying, what this passage is communicating to us, is that that scene, that funeral scene, is not the last scene. That there is a coming kingdom that Jesus is giving us a foretaste of with this interaction with this little girl. And that we can have hope of a new coming kingdom where our greatest longings are fulfilled. So, Jesus Christ transforms our identities. And secondly, he gives us a hope and a meaning that suffering and not even death can take away. Okay, so those are a couple of the beautiful things about a relationship with Jesus Christ. That's what's on offer for you. Christianity offers that to you very quickly. How do you get it? Do you notice that Jesus touches both of these people who he heals, the little girl and the woman? And the woman, who has kind of like a magical view of Jesus, thinks that her touching him is what healed her. But he, in his conversation, corrects her and says that it's her faith that has made her well. What is faith then? How do you get these blessings that we've been talking about? You make contact with Jesus. You simply go to him and put your life in his hands and say, Jesus, without you, I will not have these things. Bring your whole self to him, all your fears about yourself and your future, and lay it down at his feet. And hear him say, child, your faith has made you well. Go in peace. Let us pray. Father in heaven, thank you for your word. Thank you for this passage. And thank you that these are pretty wonderful blessings. I pray that you would, by your Spirit, give us a spirit to take them up and to really live within them. I do pray something helpful was said that someone can take away. Certainly not the whole sermon, but if something in your word has touched any of us, help us to take that and go out the door with it. We ask it in your name. Amen.